Welcome to the nowra.org.au podcast. I'm your host, Baron Hansen, and we are recording live at Triple U Studios in Nowra CBD. What is the nowra.org.au podcast? It is a series and collection of stories of the people and characters who make up the fabric of this town of Nowra. This week we have Uncle Jerry Moore. He is a Yuin man from Wreck Bay, right here in the Shoalhaven. He has over 40 years' experience in Aboriginal affairs. His previous positions include Chair of the Nowra Local Aboriginal Land Council and Chief Executive Officer of the Secretariat of the National Aboriginal and Islander Childcare, Australia's peak body representing the interests of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children and their families. He was previously Chief Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Legal Service, New South Wales and ACT. In 2020, Uncle Jerry's work as an Indigenous advocate was recognised with a Medal of the Order of Australia for his service to the Indigenous community. Uncle Jerry's work is about more than preservation, it's about connection to culture, to place and to each other. Through his leadership and presence, he continues to guide conversations around respect, understanding and what it means to truly belong in this community. And I believe he went to Nowra High, like me, just different eras. Welcome, Uncle Jerry. How you going?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Nice to have you on.
Thanks, Baron. It's great to be here.
Yeah, good. So the first question that we ask everyone who's come on this podcast so far is, what is the most underrated thing about Nowra that people always get wrong?
I think that people either misunderstand or miss altogether what a fantastic part of the world we live in. And, you know, you can talk about great beaches, you can talk about our beautiful river, but in the background there is a lot of Aboriginal history, especially in places like Kangaroo Valley, like Berrie, like Gerringong. I could go on naming them, you know, right down to Ulladulla. But I think the fact that we live in such a beautiful place is a bit underrated.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. How did you... So you grew up in Wreck Bay, but what's your earliest memory of Nowra and how did you kind of end up in this area?
Well, like in your intro, I'm from Wreck Bay, but my roots actually stem from Cullingutty, the mountain, where my great-grandparents came from, and they were moved off Cullingutty when David Berry arrived on the scene and pushed to places like Gerringer, or Rosebery Park it was called then, and to Wreck Bay. That would have been back in the early 1900s. My dad was actually born in Rosebery Park, and my mum was born in Kiama. And yeah, the history of which I take a great interest in, not only learning, but sharing about the place that I grew up in, is just, you know, it's awesome, and I think more people should be interested in it. I mean, just the fact that knowing that Nowra, where it is right now, we weren't always here. We were down at Numba, and great big floods came, and the whole town had to shift. So there is just as much important Aboriginal history of the Shoalhaven, and equally we've got some very interesting and, you know, great non-Aboriginal history that they need to be told in a truth-telling way. but always remember that we can't go back and change the past, but we can improve things for the future for our generations to come.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really resonate with that. And, you know, if we go up to Ben's Walk and you go down, there's some Aboriginal rock art there that's dated older than the pyramids, you know. Mm. Oh, it's like 7,000-year-old rock art. And the fact that that is within walking distance of our CBD, you know, it just shows just how much rich culture is just a stone's throw from where we, you know, do business and live and work. And I think that that a lot of people don't understand or forget that history is so rich just here, right here. So, yeah. What do you think has most changed about Nowra, and maybe what hasn't changed?
I think that there's been a lot of improvement that helps reconciliation. It might sound a little bit contradictory given that, you know, we just not long had a referendum and most of the country didn't agree with the yes vote. But I look at it from a glass half full perspective, and that is that there were many, many people who came out and supported that particular, you know, bit of history. And it's given people like me and others an opportunity now to talk to many people, non-Aboriginal people especially, that would have not had any interest in learning about it before. So there's been lots and lots of changes, and I don't, you know, want to or intend to get political, but I was the one who put the flag up the flagpole when a former mayor burnt it. And we've moved on in leaps and bounds from those days, you know. You can't, if you live in the past, you'll just die in anxiety and animosity and all those sorts of things. So, interestingly, I think relationships have improved. It's not to say that we still haven't got our, you know, underlying share of racism, but name a town in not just New South Wales, anywhere in the country, anywhere in the world that don't have that same particular affliction or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think I'm really passionate about change, and that's part of why I'm doing this Nowra.org.au project, trying to retell the narrative about, you know, what Nowra means to us as people. And I think that what a lot of people don't understand is change doesn't happen overnight. And your reflection on the referendum is like, actually what happened, it started a lot of good conversations, right? And it's like, we'll look back when the change does occur and we're like, oh, that was a necessary step for this to happen for us to get to, you know, that healing, that more healing place. So thanks for that optimism.
Yeah, well, you know, there's teaching from our First Nations mob over in America and Canada, where they talk about they were trying to be trodden into the ground so that they didn't exist. This is colonialism I'm talking about. But all they did was allow us to regrow in strength from being pushed into the soil. So, you know, we will evolve and progress and, you know, like there's a song that says this you know, this too shall pass. Mm. And so if I'm an over-enthusiastic or over-philosophical person, I think it's just my nature, and I like to be as infectious as I can with that.
Mm. And that is a lesson we learn from nature. Like the trees that stand the tallest have withstood the most wind, right? Mm-hmm. and that's that strength and resilience is a beautiful piece to consider as well. Yeah. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the First Nations history of Shoalhaven and Nowra. What is some of the local history that's relevant for this conversation before Europeans arrived?
Okay. Well, I'm fortunate enough to obviously be taught about our ancestry and our livelihood and our being in a country of belonging. And I'm also fortunate enough to know how everyone, meaning non-Aboriginal people, got here. And those two stories always have to be told together. I mean, you can go into any history book or Google or whatever, and you can find out that our mob, you know, were nomadic. They moved from place to place. You often hear the words, they're gone walkabout. Well, we did that for a purpose, a reason, you know. We would start in somewhere like La Perouse and walk a journey that would take us all the way across to Lake Tyres in Victoria and then cut inland over Kurnai Gunai country and then go back up over the snowy mountains where our mob would feed on Bogong moss and have big ceremonies, and then go through Monaro and Ngarigo country, back up through Braidwood to Ganangara country, up to the Parramatta River where, you know, they'd have a big festival of eels. That's how you get the Parramatta eels. Mm. And then cut back across to Bidjigal country, which is La Perouse and that area. So this was all done by what seasons there were and by navigating from the stars. And, you know, Galileo wasn't the first one to use the stars. Mm. So that's before colonisation. As we progressed, there were lots of wars, the frontier wars, the skirmishes that took place. Our people down here were, it wouldn't have been called a Jervis Bay tribe, but that's where a lot of our warriors were most feared by the Redcoats and Governor Macquarie. And they were fierce warriors and stood their ground. And all of our mob in Sydney, you know, who suffered the brunt of colonisation, they fought really hard too. And you may have heard of Pemulwuy and, what's his name? Anyway, there were some really strong warriors there. And in the end, spears and boomerangs had no effect against guns and horses. And our people probably recognised this and said, well, you know, we can't chase them away, we may as well live with them. And therein lies other prominent and important questions and history of how we all got to live in this beautiful place called the Shoalhaven. Because a couple of our warriors, Broughton and Broga, and another one by the name of Timalong and Bundle, were instrumental in bringing Charles Throsby, who was a great mate of Governor Macquarie's, down through Bowral, through Bong Bong, over the mountain at Barangaree, over Gambiwarra or Camberwarra, and eventually out to Jervis Bay. And it was then that Throsby talked to David and Alexander Berry, and they were then granted 10,000 acres of land and given 100 convicts. And they eventually, they not only raped all of our land of amazing red cedar trees that we, but they sent those cedar trees back to England, where they used them for ballast on the ships, because the ships would obviously come out full of people, cargo and so on. And they sent that shipment back to England. And from what we've learnt, there's probably furniture in Buckingham Palace that's made from furniture from here in the Shoalhaven.
Wow.
Because that's what they did. They took the timber over, and it was a type of money and trade that they used to then, you know, pay for further trips here to Australia.
Mm.
But the interesting thing is that when Alexander Berry and his brother David Berry, they eventually handed over their that land to their brother-in-law. His name was Alexander as well, and I'll think of his last name in a minute. But Berry started to go broke, and so this person, his name was Alexander Hayes, he then subdivided all of the land around Jerry Bailey, which is now known as Shoalhaven Heads, but before that was called Jerribuli, which is the Aboriginal word, and it has something to do with the meaning of the mouth of the river. And Berry, or they did that. His name was Alexander Hay. And they did that because Berry sent £100,000 back to where he studied his medicine, which was St Andrews in Scotland. And so our mob, you know, got pushed off the land, then over into Rosebery Park and Terek Bay and up to what they call the Five Islands in Wollongong and to La Perouse. So a lot of us all stem from that mountain, Cullingutty, as well as a lot of Maori people who, when the convicts had served their sentence and actually our mob were moved off, Barry then went over to New Zealand and bought out a lot of Maori people to work on the land. And one of the most prominent names for Aboriginal people and Maori people is Amato. There are lots and lots of Amatos. And that is a shortened last name of Maoris, which was Amatu. And so a lot of them married into our mob, and subsequently, you know, we end up with not just English names from intermarriage, but also Maori names. And people live on and in this beautiful place not knowing about any of that history. And it's really important to know, because it's where we all live. I'm sorry the answer was so long.
Fantastic. No, and I think, like, even me, I'm from here and I've grown up and tried to study history. There were certain things that I learned in that. So it's really nice to hear it and be in this format where we can sit and chat. But when you were talking about the nomadic lifestyle and these walkabouts that First Nations people would go on, it was quite romantic to me. I was like, it would be so beautiful to just go on a long walk where there was no roads or no cars or boundaries, and there was obviously different nations that you had to cross through, but they're moving with nature, moving with the seasons. And I do want to ask you about that. Is, like, you know, First Nations people have such a connection to nature, and yeah, is there, like, can you talk a little bit about that, I guess?
Yeah, well, before I do, I'll just tell you that most of the roads that we drive on today, and that includes the Hume Highway, the road up Barangaroo Mountain, they were built alongside of walking tracks. And when our mob would use those walking tracks, that's when the surveyors and, you know, non-Aboriginal people thought, oh, okay, well, if you can walk down there, we can build roads there. So that's just an interesting point.
I never considered that, but I'm going to think about that every time, everywhere I drive now. But yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. As far as living with nature, yeah, those long walks would entail knowing when a certain plant or tree was in bloom. We would know what wildlife were plentiful. Like when the wattles bloom, you know, certain fish would be plentiful. And we'd know where to go, where to get them. And, you know, people have been, well, I was brought up on a diet of fish, mussels, oysters, pippies, lobsters, abalone, and so on. You know, you got to pay an arm and a leg for those things today. But they were just our staple diet. And we had them because we knew what seasons you can get them in, what you can take and what you had to leave to replenish the stocks. So even the animals, you know, that we farmed, and yes, I say farmed, because one of our methods of doing that was to find a nice sort of grassy area that, you know, kangaroos and wallabies and so on would come there. But before they did, our mob would burn out burn that land, and then when the juicy young shoots would come up, that's when all of the animals would come to eat them. And our mob would be around the edges of the perimeter and would know after a certain call or signal when to start taking what they needed, not what they wanted, you know. They would take kangaroos, wallabies, not wombats, and other sorts of animals. You know, there might have been porcupines, there might have been possums, there might have been a whole lot of those animals. But that shows the ingenuity of our mob to be able to think, how can we trap these animals so that we don't have to tire ourselves out running through the bush? So living in nature or with nature, the idea is always to only take what you need. And so, you know, you might come to Ulladulla, and there'll be certain plants or animals. Then you might walk on further down to Batemans Bay, the Clyde River, and, you know, there was food, and it was a planned walk, you know, because you had oldies, kids, probably dogs, and yeah, the younger ones would always be looking out for the elders to make sure that they were okay. So you replicate those, you know, bunny hops all the way over into Victoria, and not only do you see a trail of where our people walked, lived, but you also see a bloodline, because you can mention a name to me from many states or territories or whatever, especially in New South Wales, and I can say, oh yeah, that's a Broken Hill name, or no, that's a Bree Warriner name, or no, that mob's from down the Murray, or no, they're Victorian mob. It's so, we're all so connected. Like me walking into your studio and finding the link between your dad and me and your workplace and your connection to my older brother. And it's just amazing. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. Well, that's bringing me actually to my next question that I wanted to ask you. You know, talking about community and connection, what is your role in the community? I know you've worn many hats over the years, but what hat are you currently wearing?
Well, I work in a very tough area, in child protection. And in that particular role, I see myself as what I label myself or term myself as a cultural translator, because I'm dealing with people who work in the same tough area, who may not know anything about our mob, may not know anything about our traditions, may not know anything about sorry business, may not know where a particular family comes from and how they landed here from, say, Walgett or Lightning Ridge or you name it. And so part of my role is to help connect people, and the end point of that connection is to try and make sure that we can, wherever possible and whenever possible, keep those kids and the families that we deal with together. And if they can't be kept together for, you know, extreme reasons, then we need to make sure that they are placed with family as the next option. If they can't be placed with family, then they need to be placed with kin or relatives. And if that can't happen, then we need to place them in community to keep them on country. And if that can't be done, then, you know, we sometimes have to go to the lengths where they might be or might have to live in another state, but that should be with family who've moved there. So all these efforts are made to, well, I should call them active efforts, are made to ensure the safety of the family and the parents, help them get, you know, help, whether it be substance misuse issues. Yeah, there's all sorts of things, mental health, you know, there's autism, there's FASD, or that's where babies are born with fetal alcohol syndrome and things like that. So it's a pretty tough job. Outside of that, I play many roles in the community. I'm with the First Nations Film Festival, and that's helping inspiring young Aboriginal people to learn how to make movies, plays, things like that. I'm part of an organisation called Shoalhaven Walking Together, and that's an amazing organisation which came out of the referendum, because many of our allies, many non-Aboriginal people who felt just as gutted as we did, as Aboriginal people, said, well, what can we do? How can we keep this fire burning, you know? Are we just keeping the embers warm until the next generation comes through and, you know, sparks the enthusiasm with the right timing to have another referendum? That's my hope. And this amazing organisation is all voluntary. It's made up of, like I said, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. We do a lot in the way of education in terms of having history talks. We work closely with historians like Michael Organ, who's a well-known historian, and he's written a book, you know, yay thick, about Aboriginal people on the south coast of New South Wales. And all of his work is direct from the archives. He's an archivist, so whatever material he gets is what whoever or whomever wrote down back in that period. And so there's no embellishment, you know, there's no pretend information. It's raw material. And it's things like that where I get a lot of my enthusiasm, because that's led to me talking to the Kangaroo Museum, the Berry Museum. And it's astonishing that when you talk to people, they haven't communicated, A, because no one's asked them, or B, they didn't know how to approach someone to ask was it right to, you know, approach you about this or that? And the other reason is, you know, they feel intimidated and they haven't actually met an Aboriginal person before. And so I see that not as a deficit, but as an opportunity to talk to people who would normally be hard to contact or communicate with, and all they're waiting for is someone to say, hey, let's have a yarn, you know? And one of my favourite things is talking to older people, you know, not just our elders, our Aboriginal elders, but non-Aboriginal people. And you find them in museums and historical societies, not as exhibits, but, you know, they're the ones who've got the most passion for history. And when you start talking to these people, they know a lot more than they've ever let on. It's just that they haven't had someone turn the tap on before to say, hey, do you know back in the 30s, my dad used to own a log truck, and of a weekend, that flatbed truck was used to cart the Aboriginal football team from Nowra to Ulladulla or Nowra to Berry or Kiama. And these are old guys that, you know, non-Aboriginal guys that they, if you make people feel comfortable, they will open up. And like I said, they have so much knowledge, so much wisdom, and nowhere to store it, you know. So that's probably one of my passions, is talking to older people and Rotaries, Probus clubs, you know, schools. I went and talked to the year 11, 10 and 11 Aboriginal students who were doing Aboriginal studies in Shoalhaven High through the week. And I think that there are many people who miss out on being taught Aboriginal history in our days because it just wasn't a thing. And it's also very hard to kickstart it even today, because we wait for them to get to years 11, 10, 11 and 12, and then we try to enthuse them, whereas I think we should be whetting their appetite from the first day they go to high school, and even further back, the first day they go to preschool, you know, because then we will have generations that won't have missed out on what we missed out on when we were kids growing up. And all of our non-Aboriginal brothers and sisters will have that same opportunity too. And of course, the next big thing is language. And it's heartening to know that some of our schools are teaching Dharuga and Dharawal. And Dharawal is the language spoken on the northern side of the river, and Dharuga is spoken on the south side of the river. But the river was never seen as a dividing line. The river was seen as a meeting place, because that's where you would come, trade, exchange, learn, swap songs or ceremonies. And so it's a really, all of the rivers play an important part, just like the mountains. So, yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. And yeah, really beautiful articulation. And actually, you've answered a couple of my questions that I was going to ask anyway. How can people better engage with First Nations culture here in Nowra?
Well, once again, I think, Baron, this is a really great opportunity for people to soak up and, you know, take in what culture is already on offer. And if you look at our younger generation who are coming through now, you've got Gadigal Murring who are, you know, going into the schools, teaching, working alongside of people like myself, and they're educating people. So, and then you've got Jiriba Woggara, which is another Koori organisation that's doing all of the cultural stuff. And you've got young lads who are working in with Bundanon, who take them on interpretive bushwalks. And then you've got what I'm trying to do, or what Swatter or Shalavan Walking Together is trying to nourish and grow, and that's holding talks with non-Aboriginal people. And look, it's no good of just targeting the choir, you know. You've got to go out of your comfort zone. I'm talking about me as a cultural translator or interpreter, and go into the lion's den and talk to people who would like to put forward their view, and it's not necessarily aligned with your view, but there's an opportunity to change it if it's delivered in the right way, if there's context around it, and if people feel safe enough to be able to ask a question that they've never wanted to ask before. You know, it's like someone in a wheelchair, you know. They feel threatened. They know not to go up and ask that person, "Oh, do you like being in that wheelchair?" It's just, you know. But then if that person in the wheelchair is willing to say, "Hey, would you like to hear my story?" You know, it puts a whole different connotation on things. So I think learning and soaking up the culture that already exists, and above all, having an open mind, you know, being curious, wanting to ask questions, but making sure it's in a setting where people can feel culturally safe, that they can ask a question and not get someone shake a stick at them, or someone shaking their fist at the sky and saying, "Don't you know this, you know, blah, blah, blah." And so I think taking advantage of what we already have here, we've got Unreal Museum out at Husky, you know. We're working with the museum up in Kangaroo Valley to see how we can help with them, you know, presenting more Aboriginal content and stuff. Berry Museum, they've been really, really open. You know, I did a talk over in Berry last year, and it was standing room only in the hall, you know, because people wanted to come along. People wanted to hear, why is it called Berry, you know? And you can put across the truth about David Berry, who did some not so good things, as well as still talk about some of the good things that people hold him in their regard for. And, you know, there's some people there who think, oh, okay, well, now I've got a different idea, you know, and okay, I get why I'm living in this beautiful place now, because they've not been told the truth and they've not been told real history. And let's face it, history is written through the eye of the, you know, the conqueror. So truth-telling is a really big thing that we should be all engaging in, but done appropriately.
And you touched on two points there, you know, openness and curiosity. And I think a big part of what this nowra.org.au project is giving people the space to do that and retelling the story of Nowra. You know, what does Nowra now look like? Yeah, we have this history, we have this rich history, but now, you know, what is Nowra like today and moving into the future? And I think like having that openness and curiosity has definitely been part of the tenets of this podcast and what we're trying to do with the project as well. So, yeah, thanks for sharing that. Has there been any moment in Nowra that has left a lasting positive impression on you?
I would say yes, but not just in one particular area. If you look at it like it was a flower or a daffodil or something, you know, there's leaves all around the centre which have been small steps or positive steps or learning steps or teaching steps. So one of my good engagements in this beautiful place that we live in is we have a vibrant business chamber. I used to be part of that business chamber. And, you know, they're doing a really good job in struggling times, trying to make sure that Nowra has a high profile, and I think they do it really well. The hospital, I really want to emphasise that having our own cancer centre here and this big new hospital that's being built, we're just so blessed. I mean, I'm talking from a personal point of view now where I've had to use their services, and I can't speak highly enough of the treatment that I received and didn't have to hop on a bus to go to Wollongong or Sydney for treatment. It is state of the arts and it is fantastic. That leads me on to housing, and I think that there are some really good progress being made. I think the more affordable housing we can get in Nowra is a really good thing. But I think too that having housing that's going to house doctors, dentists, teachers, professionals, you know, Navy, it's important too. So having good housing infrastructure and good planning, and I know the council, you know, are trying to do their best and are in trying times themselves. But, you know, I think there's a part for us all to play in that, even if it's as small as saying, hey, can we put a bit of effort into this area or that area, you know? the teaching of history, you know, it's leaving a really big impression on me, because I'm finding that people want to learn. You know, I'm finding that people are curious. So that's a good thing. I think also the fact that we've got a really strong Aboriginal organisational presence in Nowra and surrounds means that people are seeing, you know, the young ones, the young ladies mainly, who are working in Wominda, which, you know, I think they're up over 200 staff these days. In the AMS, you know, the Aboriginal Medical Service, once again, they're seeing it's high visibility with all of the Koori stuff that we all walk around in, and even government departments like who I work for, you know, all have the Aboriginal design shirts and so forth. And that's a positive for the town, you know. They're really, really great organisations. And there's others that are sort of, you know, don't get as much airplay, but they're doing their jobs, you know, the land councils, the housing organisations, our Wreck Bay Community Council, you know, and what they do out at Buttery National Park that adds to the economy of the Shoalhaven. We've got a lot to be thankful for. It's taken a while to get here, but I think the foundations now are really rock solid, and we can just not sit back and rest on our laurels, but have a strategy or an attitude of continuous improvement in services for not just our mob, but for everyone. Because if you go to the AMS and you're a non-Aboriginal person, you still get the opportunity to be, you know, looked after, especially if you're married to a non-Aboriginal person, you know. And Wominda's got their birthing centre, their rehab or refuge just opened up the other day. The amount of young people I see working in these organisations makes you feel really proud, you know, knowing that there's these young ones coming along behind you who are going to carry the baton forward. They might not always be in tune with the way you think as an older person, but hey, old things eventually have to give up their secrets and, you know, move on to the hereafter. And we've got to respect and stand back in the shade so that these young people can shine. Mm-hmm. And that's an imperative, not a request or a suggestion. That's an imperative that we let young people shine, that we let them make mistakes so that they can learn from mistakes, but above all, that we help guide rather than hang on to the baton like a dog with a bone, you know. Here, you guys take it.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful segue into my second to last question, but what do you hope Nowra feels like in 10 years?
Well, coming from an era when our ladies couldn't work or walk into a shop without being followed, without not being accused of, or any Aboriginal person not being accused of shoplifting, I remember being in one shop here when I was much, much younger and got accused of trying to steal a pair of yellow Speedos. I said, you go and get your manager. And the young person did. The manager come back. What's happening, you know? And the young one said, oh, I believe, da-da-da-da-da-da. And the manager said, okay, sir, well, if you haven't got anything to hide, would you mind emptying your pockets? And I said, sure, you know, you've asked nicely, and I've got nothing to hide. And I emptied my pockets. And, of course, then I had to say to both of them, now, I want you to know one thing. And they said, yes, I apologise for, you know, accusing you of doing this, and the young person will apologise shortly. Caught dead in a pair of yellow Speedos with my coloured skin. Anyway, you know, that's a long time ago, and there was a time when our mob couldn't even go into one of the cafes. And now, we're always seeing, not as often, but seeing young Aboriginal people working in retail, chemists, tyre shops, car yards even. It's a huge leap when you now look at Black Seed, one of our, you know, highlights in town, I guess. The place is never, hardly ever empty. And sometimes I think, oh, I'm not going there because I can't eat a meal in peace. You know, everyone knows you. But it is such a fantastic asset to this town because it screams success. It screams progress. It screams opportunities for young people. And it screams reconciliation, you know. The amount of people who go in there, most of them, on many occasions, aren't always our mob. It's everyone, you know. And that is just awesome. And the fact that that organisation have been able to branch out into that area is just a huge feather, not only in their caps, but in the caps of this town for embracing, utilising, patronising, you know, that service that, yeah, we should all be proud.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is. It's something that so many people in Nowra are proud of. And when people come to town, it's like, where do you take them? Take them there. And that is, you know, as in your words, reconciliation as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that we're really, yeah, our town's really getting behind. So it's good.
So, yeah, just to finish off, where would I like to see us in 10 years' time? I'd like to see us more involved, more integrated in community. I'd like to see us having another crack at a referendum. You know, there's an old saying that says it's only impossible till it's done. And, yeah, how many successful people do we all know that have failed on their first attempt or second attempt or whatever? I think old Gough Whitlam stood for pre-selection or stood for Prime Minister about five times before he got there. And like I said, it's only impossible until it's done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, last question. Who is the one person you'd love to hear their story on this podcast?
That's a difficult question for me to answer because there's so many from, you know, the up-and-coming, young and inspiring to some of our elders that we need to capture their story before it's too late. If I had a choice of having two people, say a male and a female, I would say Auntie Delia Lowe from out at Jirringer, who's been a stalwart in Aboriginal activism and, you know, trying to further advance our cause for I don't know how many years. And Uncle Sonny Sims, who is a knowledge holder, I think unrivaled here in town and in many places all the way along the coast from Lapa down to the border, who just has so much knowledge and wisdom and stories. I think you'd have trouble just getting him over the first story, so you'd have to structure him. But, yeah, he's definitely worth listening to.
All right, Auntie Delia and Uncle Sonny, we're coming out for you for season two. And lastly, are there any asks of the people of Nowra?
I think be kind. I think be curious. I think make yourself aware so that we're all informed next time we get asked a question like we did in the referendum. I think we've got some really good causes that people need to be aware of, share and contribute to. There are things like my friend Gemma Tribe with the food bank in town. There are people who are always, you know, looking to raise money for cancer. It's such a blight on our community. All people, it discriminates against no one. And yeah, you know, just wherever you can contribute, try and do your best, but keep within your means, because just that little bit could help someone. And there's a saying that I always use that goes, everything you do and say makes a difference. And that's an ask I would give.
Thanks, Uncle Jerry. It's been such a pleasure to have your wisdom on the show. And yeah, it's been really nice having a yarn with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Nowra.org.au podcast. I'm your host, Baron Hansen. We're recording in Triple U Studios in Nowra CBD. It's a community radio station. Our producer here is Paul Murphy. Nowra.org.au is funded by the New South Wales Government Uptown Accelerator Program. If you'd like more information, visit Nowra.org.au or follow us on socials, subscribe to the mailing list. See you next time.